race neutral, he will allow the strike. If not, then the prosecution cannot strike the juror, and the juror is guaranteed to sit on the jury. As we kept going, I kept raising objections, and I could tell that Mark, of Asian descent, was getting more upset by the minute. He finally burst out with a statement about how offended he was. "As a person of color, I am offended by Mr. Baez's insinuations," he barked. "You're a person of color," I responded, just to piss him off. "Yes, I am," he said as his face turned red. "Do people cross the street to avoid you when you walk down the street at night?" I couldn't resist. "All right, that's enough," Locke interrupted. This was the first of many skirmishes I'd have with the prosecution, and it gave me a good sense of how to upset Mark Lee. "Let's save that for later," I thought to myself. Overall, the effect of all the Batson challenges paid off, because after Mark's "I'm a person of color" speech, the prosecution did not strike any more Hispanics or African Americans, even those clearly biased for the defense. We ended up with an overwhelmingly minority jury of 4 Hispanics and 4 African Americans. Prosecutors also tipped their hand in a big way during jury selection. I always look for clues as to how prosecutors are going to try their case by listening to some of the questions they ask potential jurors. It wasn't too hard to figure out their plan, since Mark Lee asked every single juror the same 3 questions. 1. Could you convict if there wasn't any forensic evidence tying the defendant to the crime? 2. Could you convict if you didn't believe the motive for the crime? 3. Could you convict if the state's chief witness cut a deal for himself? Basically, they kept asking the jurors, could you convict Aaron Hernandez, even though there is no evidence against him and our main witness is a snitch who cut a deal to save himself? I had to keep fighting not to smile every time I heard these questions. Did they think these people were stupid? And wouldn't they see right away that something was up? I knew right then and there I would have to scratch my opening statement and center it around these questions. The opportunity to preempt their argument was just too good to pass up. Patrick Hagen would deliver the opening statements for the prosecution. As expected, he was good, really good. He began by describing the early morning hours of July 16th, 2012. His theme was that of two worlds colliding, the world of hard-working immigrants, the Cape Verdeans, and the world of a privileged celebrity athlete. He described how Daniel de Abreu was a former police officer in Cape Verde, a fact detailed nowhere in the evidence turned over to the defense. And Zafiro Furtado was a former tour guide who had been in this country only months before that fateful night. He described how these two worlds by mere chance interacted with one another in Cure, how these hard-working immigrants had to pay a cover charge, yet the celebrity football player did not. He began painting Aaron as a hothead, a self-entitled prick, while these poor immigrants were just out for a rare night on the town. One of them would bump into the celebrity who frequented nightclubs and lived the good life. What Hagen was doing was trying to get the jury to hate Aaron. Deep down inside, many people hate professional athletes because they appear to have it all. Youth, money, fame, all for playing a game. What we don't see is the hard work that goes into being one of the very few who actually make it in professional sports. The sacrifices they make as children, as their parents push them to fulfill the dreams they never could. While other children are playing video games and riding their bikes, these future stars are running more laps, catching more passes. I knew after hearing Hagen describe Aaron this way that I would have to remind the jury of the sacrifices Aaron made. Nobody gave Aaron anything. Whatever he gained in life, he had to work for, and it should not be held against a person because they decided to work hard enough to fulfill the American dream, I would later tell the jury. I tried to emphasize how athletes do this at a great risk of their current and future health just so we can enjoy a game. Little did I know how true that was in this particular case. Hagen then moved on to Bradley, describing him as Aaron's best friend and future godfather of Aviel. What a crock, I thought to myself as the words came out of Hagen's mouth. I made sure I did not show any expression on my face as he said this. Years earlier in the Casey Anthony trial, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that the prosecutor Jeff Ashton was laughing as I was delivering my arguments. He had been doing it throughout the trial, and I had asked the judge to instruct him to stop on multiple occasions. But the judge kept saying he didn't see him laughing, so when I saw him doing it at closing, I pointed to Ashton and said, "It doesn't matter who is asking the questions, whether it's me or this laughing guy right here." It was a powerful moment in the trial, because mocking an opponent's arguments is an incredibly stupid thing for a lawyer to do. Jurors hate that, as they are the triers of facts, not the lawyers. There would be none of that in this trial. Hagen was the consummate professional, and I knew better. but my mind could not help but wander as I imagined Bradley, the gun-toting drug dealer, in church. Ridiculous, I thought, as I jotted down a reminder to point out the inaccuracy to the jury. Most lawyers have a set script of what they want to tell a jury during opening statements. I use only an outline because my mentor, Rick DeMaria, from the Miami-Dade Public Defender's Office, would always tell me that nothing is more persuasive to a jury than when you take what the prosecutor says during opening and use it against them. Responding to the prosecution in the opening has been a habit of mine ever since, and I truly believe the strategy has served me well. I think that psychologically for the jury, it sets the stage for the dynamic to come. The prosecutor will tell you one thing, but I will be the one to show you the true meaning of that evidence, or show you something else entirely. Hagen next tried to cushion the blows we would aim at Bradley by explaining that Bradley was honest to a fault, or perhaps too honest. Can you believe that? A prosecutor warning the jury that their star witness was going to be too honest, as if that was a bad thing. Hagen knew Bradley had baggage, and lots of it. This was his way of diffusing the power of Bradley's criminal record, which no doubt would give any jury pause. He then concluded that the proof or corroboration of Bradley's testimony would come in the hundreds of text messages between Bradley and Aaron after the West Palm Beach shooting, when Bradley was attempting to extort money from Aaron. He forecast that the process of reviewing texts would be long and tedious, but in among all the messages they would find not only the truth about what happened in West Palm Beach, but at least one reference to the double homicide in Boston. My ears perked up. I had read those messages multiple times and knew every word that was said. I looked over at Michelle Medina, my right-hand woo man, as I jokingly call her. Michelle goes through all the evidence in my cases with me as a second set of eyes. She is my secret weapon and has been with me for years. I would not have close to the amount of success I've achieved in the practice of law if it were not for her. As I turned to her, she looked at me at the same time, and she knew exactly what I was saying inside to myself, as she had heard it a million times before. Michelle? What the fuck is he talking about? Our eyes met, and she shook her head slightly so only I could see, telling me it was not true. I could then relax and focus on my opening, which was coming up next. I cannot even begin to tell you how many of my courtroom rants poor Michelle has withstood. A trial is by far the most stressful event I can possibly describe. A person's life hangs in the balance, on every word said in the courtroom, and we as humans are bound to make mistakes. I really have to take this opportunity to publicly apologize for all those times in the middle of all those battles when I completely freaked out and made her the focus of my wrath. Sorry, Mishy. She is directly responsible for all my courtroom victories, and there will never be a better example than the Aaron Hernandez trial and those goddamn text messages, as a prosecutor would later call them. Finally, it was my turn, and as I rose, I immediately tackled the three questions prosecutors asked all of the jury members during selection. 1. Could you convict if you didn't believe the motive as described by Alexander Bradley? 2. Could you convict if there was no forensic evidence tying Aaron Hernandez to the crime? 3. Could you convict if you didn't believe Alexander Bradley? My third question was a little different than the one prosecutors had actually asked, could you convict if the state's chief witness cut a deal for himself? But the issue remained the same. You couldn't convict Aaron Hernandez unless you truly believed Alexander Bradley. These were all major weaknesses in the prosecution's case, and I was not about to let the jury forget it. The words of my mentor Rick DeMaria echoed in my mind. Take what they say and use it against them. I outlined the defense case as best I could, constantly reiterating my theme. Could you convict if there wasn't any evidence? Putting my hands together in a prayer-like motion, I talked about the missing video from Cure, and I could see the surprise in a couple of jurors' faces. I talked about the missing photo taken by the fan inside Cure, and how the cops never looked for it. Now I was seeing anger in their eyes. I talked about the crime scene and how the bodies of Abreu and Furtado were disrespected, and I could see the eyebrows of a couple of jurors coming together in disbelief. I pointed out all the inconsistencies and lies in Bradley's testimony in both Boston and West Palm Beach. Apparently, as I was giving my remarks, a fire alarm was going off in the background as loud as could be. I didn't hear it, and neither did the jury. The room was as quiet as the alarm was loud. I left nothing unaddressed, from the mysterious behavior of the guys in the BMW to Bradley's mountain of lies. I thought I hit all the points I needed to, but the press thought my opening argument was a big flop. The next day, March 2nd, 2017, Bob McGovern's article on the front page of the Boston Herald read, strong offense, not the best defense for Aaron Hernandez. He went on to write, Jose Baez has multiple ways to try and get former New England Patriot Aaron Hernandez out of double murder charges, but showing a brutal lack of respect to prosecutors, police, and Bay State investigators isn't a smart tactic. I don't know a single person in this world, if they were accused of murder, who would want their lawyer to hold back good evidence-based arguments against the prosecutors or police. The fact is, I was not there to make friends with the prosecutors or police. I was there to defend a man facing life in prison, and he didn't say, while you're doing it, please be nice. To the contrary, when I was done, I began walking back to the defense table, and while my colleagues were patting me on the back and offering words of encouragement, my eyes were fixed on Aaron's. I saw a brightness there I had never seen before. He was pleased. I didn't know it at the time, but in the middle of my opening statement, Aaron handed Michelle a note that read, OMG, Jose is so fucking good. Duh, who the hell do you think you hired? Michelle wrote back. When Michelle showed me the note, it warmed my heart. Nothing pleases me more than when my clients are happy with my work. I never take the trust they put in me lightly. It's an awesome responsibility. Actually, a mind-racking, stressful one. For the first time, I saw hope in Aaron's eyes, followed by those famous words he uttered when we first decided to go on this journey together. Fuck yeah. Chapter 17. Independent and Not-So-Independent Witnesses. The prosecution began its case by putting on families of the victims to do what Massachusetts law calls humanizing the proceedings. I have never been a fan of this. What they do is start the trial by calling a tearful family member to testify and entering into evidence a photograph of the victim. The trial begins with an obvious effort to pull the heartstrings and emotions of the jury. Before you go thinking that I'm cold, look at it from this perspective. The law has a theory, which is that the jury should base its decision on the evidence, not on emotion. I cannot agree more with this concept. We do not want jurors making decisions based on emotion. I believe this concept took root in the 1960s, when criminal justice reform was enacted after a series of miscarriages of justice during the civil rights era. Dispensing justice based on emotion was another form of lynching. You aren't taking someone out of their cell and hanging them in front of the courthouse. But what you are doing is putting them on trial, making the jury angry about this horrible crime, and then pointing the finger at the accused. Someone must pay for this horrible crime. Recent case law has trended away from this line of thinking, and for good reason. Think about it this way. You have a prosecutor putting family members on the stand to evoke sympathy from the jury. Yet at the end of the trial, you have the judge instructing the jury that they are to base their decisions on facts, not feelings. After the victim's families took the stand and offered little information about who could have committed this crime, the prosecution shifted focus to the crime scene. We all spent the next 2 weeks listening to each and every officer on the stand confirm three main things. That they knew little about how to properly process a crime scene, that they had no idea who had placed sheets on the bodies or where the sheets came from, and that all of them had heard from another officer that a street sweeper had passed by, but no one had seen it, and no one could identify the officer who had. Next up were the eyewitnesses, including numerous people involved throughout the investigation. There are two very important things to remember when relying on eyewitness testimony. One is the difference between independent witnesses and interested witnesses. The descriptions are pretty straightforward. Independent witnesses do not have a dog in the fight. They have no interest in the outcome of the litigation. The interested witness, simply stated, have a motive or a reason to slant their testimony one way or the other. The problem with high-profile cases is that independent witnesses can evolve into interested ones due to peer pressure or a sense of moral duty or the prospect of financial gain if they feel they can make money off their story. We are all human beings motivated by wants and desires, and while making a statement under oath is meaningful to all of us, I have often seen a person's commitment to the truth start to wane in the glare of the spotlight. This is something we had to look out for throughout this case. The best example of the interested witnesses would be the three surviving Cape Verdeans inside the BMW. I will begin with Rashide Sanchez. You may recall that Sanchez was seated in the rear passenger side of the BMW. Aside from Safiro Furtado, who was killed, Sanchez should have gotten the best view of the killer. But while in the BMW, Sanchez wanted one of his rap songs to be played, so I don't know how much attention he was paying to the SUV next to him. By his own account, he testified he was not paying much attention. He didn't go to the police station until the day after the incident because he fled the scene the night of the shooting. He took a cab home covered in blood and then burnt his clothes. He discussed the case with fellow victim, Gerson Lopez, before going to the police station to give a statement. On July 16, 2012, Sanchez described the driver as a white boy, American-looking, wearing a white hat with a logo of a different color. He did not see the driver's face. He believed the passenger was female and the gun was black, but could not give any further description. Now, this description should be analyzed in the following way. First, Rashide Sanchez did not have a strong command of the English language and did not use an interpreter when speaking to the police. This was a colossal blunder on the police's part. A perfect example is the term white boy. Sanchez is dark-skinned black. Later on in the same statement, he used the term white boy to describe Daniel De Abreu, who Americans would describe as either light-skinned African-American or dark-skinned Hispanic. Both guns described in this case were chrome, not black, and nobody wore a white hat, although Aaron had on a gray hat at various points in the evening. Brian Kwan, an independent witness, was a security guard who saw the SUV before it ran the red light, and did not have to endure a stressful event like Sanchez. He testified the driver was African-American, did not wear a hat, and was not young, maybe 30s or 40s. Aaron was 22 at the time, and Bradley was 30 and a light-skinned African-American. Kwan also said the passenger might have been a female and had long shoulder-length hair with beads and cornrows. Kwan's description of the passenger was more detailed than Sanchez's description, but not inconsistent with it. Donald Gobin, the driver in the car with Kwan, gave a similar description. Bear in mind that when witnesses have an opportunity to talk about what they saw, they almost always give the same description. That takes us to Gerson Lopez, who did not testify at trial, but spoke to police. He had been seated behind the driver in the BMW and had the opportunity to talk to Sanchez as they went to the police station together. He also said the driver was white. Again, keep in mind that the prosecution was arguing that Bradley, a light-skinned African-American male, was the driver. Yet Lopez described the driver as wearing a green hat and in his 20s. Lopez's statement would never see the light of day, as a few days later, Gerson Lopez returned to the police station and told a tale that did not match what everyone else was saying. He said he got a partial license plate, which he put in his phone as the shooting was occurring, and that after Abreu and Furtado were shot, the SUV then sped off, turned around, and shots were fired at the BMW from the front. It was a bizarre tale the police questioned immediately. Lopez did believe the shooting was drug-related, saying he recognized somebody at the club who thought Lopez was involved in a shooting at a weed house in Dorchester, Massachusetts. This grabbed my interest, as Bradley was a marijuana trafficker, and this would have explained everything. But Lopez's tales just spun bigger and wilder. After Aaron was named in the media as a suspect, Lopez described Aaron to a T and said he actually got into a fight with Aaron in Cure because Lopez was hitting on Shayana. At the time of the shooting, Shayana was in Florida. And he and Aaron had been fighting, rolling around on the club floor. He said he feared for his safety because every time he walked down the streets of Roxbury, a town on the outskirts of Boston, the Puerto Ricans began throwing furniture at him. My star witness was disappearing before my eyes. I certainly didn't want the jury to start throwing furniture at me if I called him to the stand, so off he went, not to be called by the defense or the prosecution. Aquilino Friere was seated in the middle rear seat of the BMW and could not give any description at all, except that he heard the SUV pull up and somebody say, "How are you guys doing?" He said he believed someone in the SUV might have been female, but could not tell the race or give any descriptions of those in the SUV. That is, of course, until Aaron Hernandez was named as a suspect. Then his story changed, and he claimed the driver of the SUV was white Hispanic with lots of tattoos on his arms and wore a black hat. Friere went on to state that the driver said, "What's up, Negroes?" not, "How are you guys doing?" As he testified before the grand jury in the Boston shootings, Friere admitted to researching Aaron on the internet and TV news and stated that Aaron's voice was exactly the same as the guy who said, "What's up, Negroes?" and that the shooter was in fact Aaron Hernandez. The one constant in Friere's testimony was that he saw someone in the car who looked like a female. Sanchez would also change his testimony after Aaron was named as the suspect, saying the driver was Hispanic and had tattoos. He further stated that the driver's gun was an automatic, and the shooter was shooting with his left hand. It should be noted that after Aaron was named as a suspect, the website TMZ had posted a photograph of Aaron taking a selfie with his phone in his right hand and a semi-automatic pistol in his left hand. Sanchez would later admit to seeing the photograph. I think it was clear he thought Aaron was left-handed because in the photo he had the gun in his left hand. The only two constants in all of the witnesses' statements, constants that remained unchanged even after Aaron was named as a suspect, were that the shooter was the driver and the passenger looked like a female. As you can see, the witness statements were all over the place, and Massachusetts has really strong case law that allowed us to move to exclude the descriptions that both Sanchez and Freire were about to give after being influenced by media accounts and stories. We filed the motion, and to my surprise, Judge Locke granted it. I say to my surprise because most judges, in all cases, high profile or not, rarely grant defense motions. They're granted occasionally when the cameras are not present, but next to never when the news is watching. No judge wants to be seen as soft on crime or as letting someone off on a technicality. I knew right then and there that Judge Locke was going to give us a fair trial, and I liked our chances even better. The ruling didn't really tip the scale in our favor all that much, actually, because I would have been able to point out the discrepancies in their stories to the jury during cross-examination, and Sanchez and Freire would have looked like liars. Maybe Locke was doing the prosecution a favor by excluding them, but I don't think so. Locke seemed to try his best with all his rulings, and I respected him immensely for it. He called them like he saw them, and didn't give consideration to how a ruling made him look. One night, after a long day of court, about midway through the trial, I went to get a haircut. As I was sitting in the barber's chair, my phone went off. I didn't answer because the man had a pair of scissors right next to my ears. The ringer went off again and again. I realized something was up, so as soon as he was done, I checked my messages. My office had forwarded a voicemail from a guy in California. He was a realtor who was watching the trial on the internet and heard my opening statement. He heard my arguments about the police not wanting to look for the picture of Aaron and the fan taken inside Cure that night. He took it as a personal challenge to find the picture, and find it he did. The guy scoured the internet and found it on the Facebook page of a guy named Antoine Salvador, or Junior. I was shocked. I had Jerry Lyons, my investigator, pull every driver's license taken from the Cure video scanner and talk to everyone he could find. Some of the IDs were not clear on the video, and for some reason he couldn't find phone numbers. I also had several interns look all over the internet, and nothing. This guy in California combed the internet and checked friends of friends and so on, and eventually found what no one from our team could. While I was excited to get the information and the photograph, I have to admit I was kind of bummed that we didn't find it ourselves. Not being the one to find this critical piece of evidence was a total blow to my ego, but better this guy in California than nobody at all. The client comes first. I immediately sent Jerry and Gian Favors, our head intern and recent Harvard Law School graduate, to talk to Junior Salvador. I gave them strict instructions not to leave his house without a recorded statement because I knew once we turned this evidence over to the prosecution, Mr. Salvador was going to get a little visit from Boston detectives. The fan, as we originally called him, turned out to be a psychology doctoral student. He had no idea the trial was going on or even that he held one of the most important pieces of evidence in it. Junior was at Cure with a few of his friends that night celebrating his birthday. He was standing at the main bar when he immediately recognized Aaron Hernandez as he walked in with what looked like a group of guys. He said as soon as Aaron walked in, he walked away from the large group of guys and went to the bar to get a drink. Junior said he could see Aaron was still with one guy, but the guy was standing a few feet away. After a couple of minutes of building up the nerve, he finally walked up to Aaron and asked him for a picture. Aaron politely declined. Junior then told Aaron it was his birthday, and Aaron quickly relented. But Aaron insisted they walk somewhere private so others could not see him taking a picture. Junior walked up to Jamie Furtado and asked for access to the back room, which Furtado denied. Seeing the look on Junior's face, Aaron asked Furtado himself. Furtado finally agreed and was the one who took the picture. After getting his photo, Junior thanked Aaron profusely, then went back to show his friends. He told us he was amazed to see Aaron return to the bar instead of some VIP area. He watched him for about a minute as Aaron waited at the bar for his drink. Junior said he then walked up to Aaron again to thank him once more and offered to buy Aaron a drink. Junior told us Aaron politely declined. Junior said that Aaron's drinks arrived and he left the bar right after with his drinks in his hands. This is confirmed by the video near the entrance/exit of Cure, which shows Aaron walking out alone with two drinks in his hands. He chugs them before exiting through the door. Bradley is seen several steps behind him walking out on his own, contrary to his testimony, which was that he had to usher an angry Aaron outside of the bar. Just like that, we had a star independent witness, one who had no interest in the outcome of the case, who could testify about almost every second of the 9 minutes Aaron spent in Cure. No spilled drink, no interaction with Abreu, no fight. Nothing but a rather uneventful 9 minutes. Junior would tell the jury that his entire interaction and observation of Aaron lasted approximately 7 to 10 minutes. But the prosecution was not about to take this blow to their case lying down. On cross-examination, Prosecutor Mark Lee tried to break down every second as if he held an imaginary stopwatch, asking, "So you saw him walk down the stairs, and that took about 30 seconds?" A puzzled Junior answered, "I suppose so." "And then another 30 seconds to walk to the main bar?" Lee asked. "Sure," replied Junior. Lee was timing every detail in Junior's story and coming up with a total that was more like 4 or 5 minutes, the implication being that Junior could not, in fact, account for all of Aaron's actions in the bar, and there could have been an altercation he missed. Lee's Perry Mason moment culminated with, "So it was actually 4 or 5 minutes that you observed Aaron Hernandez, and not 7 to 10 as you testified to under direct examination?" A perplexed Junior shrugged his shoulders and said, "Okay." My co-counsel Sully responded brilliantly by showing Junior a photograph of himself that evening. "Mr. Salvador, what is that thing around your neck that is depicted in this photograph?" "A tie?" Junior answered with a "where the fuck is this going?" look on his face. "It's not a stopwatch, is it, sir?" asked Sully. "No," Junior responded. "So you weren't in the nightclub walking around with a stopwatch checking every action and timing it, were you, sir?" Sully asked sarcastically. "No, sir, I wasn't," Junior shot back. This exchange was followed up with probably one of the most impactful moments of the trial when Sully asked, "Sir, all of this back and forth about 4 to 5 minutes or 7 to 10 minutes, do you have any idea what it's all about?" "No," Junior said while shrugging. The point was made loud and clear. This guy was just there to tell the truth. All he did was ask for a picture with a football player, and 3 years later, he's sitting in a courtroom with no reason to lie and not a care as to who wins or loses. After all the back and forth of what happened inside the club, Junior had one more bombshell to offer. After he exited the club, the outside club video showed him walking across the street toward the W Hotel. At the same time, about 100 yards away, there were two shadowy figures near the Tufts garage that prosecutors said were Aaron and Bradley. But Junior would tell the jury that minutes later he saw Aaron Hernandez walking with another guy toward the W, not the garage. Junior was the second witness, after Cure bouncer Ugo Ojimba, to testify to this fact. The third would be another bouncer at Cure, now a firefighter, named Andrew Wallace. This made a grand total of 3 independent witnesses who all saw Aaron over by the W at and around the time of the murders. The message was clear. Aaron couldn't be in 2 places at once, and testimony that proved Alexander Bradley was lying was beginning to sound like a broken record. Chapter 18. The Street Sweeper. You can go into a trial thinking you have every I dotted and every T crossed, only to face an unexpected setback or an unexpected stroke of luck in the form of a surprise witness. Junior Salvador in his photograph was an example of the latter, and so was Warren McMaster, the street sweeper. McMaster was a 26-year-old street-smart kid from South Boston, or a Southie. He had driven a sweeper for American Sweeper for about 5 years, working the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift, during which he cleaned a different route each day of his 5-day work week. He was driving on the right curb of Marginal Road the morning of July 16, 2012, when he turned left on Shawmut Avenue and hugged the right curb heading toward Herald Street. He could immediately see a BMW ahead that had just been shot at, and right next to it was a white or light-colored SUV. As 2 men stumbled out of the car, McMaster saw what he said appeared to be a woman with her head sticking out of the sunroof of the SUV, apparently recording the scene with an iPhone. The SUV then bolted about a minute before Warren's sweeper passed within 15 feet of the BMW. As police started to arrive, McMaster continued on his route before receiving a call from his supervisor, telling him to go back and speak to the police, which he did. "We might never have known about the street sweeper had Officer Thomas O'Donnell not included it in his report from the night of the shootings." Officer O'Donnell was one of the first officers on the scene, and apparently the only one who bothered to mention the street sweeper among the thousands of reports filed. "I may have never in my life heard of a street sweeper driving through a crime scene before, but what was the overall significance of this?" I figured we would use the fact to show that if people in the BMW had fired shots at the SUV, the street sweeper would have swept away any evidence. Additionally, the fact that a street sweeper went through and nobody investigated it thoroughly was just plain sloppy, and whenever you have sloppy work, cops always try to cover it up. What's the saying? The wrong deed is never the problem, it's always the cover-up. That was it. I never believed the street sweeper was going to be more significant than that. But little did I know the prosecution was worried about his potential testimony and was going to try and sweep him under the rug, pun intended. When you push your opponent about careless police work and question their evidence enough, sometimes they do something really stupid, and in this case, the prosecution did just that. Unbeknownst to me, in the middle of the trial, probably around the time we were attacking everyone for allowing the street sweeper to drive through the crime scene, the prosecution subpoenaed the street sweeper to come to court under the guise of having him testify. I say the guise because there's no way they were going to call him. His testimony was not going to help their case, plus they were already past reviewing the crime scene personnel and into another area of their case, so I believe it was complete and total nonsense. What they really called McMaster in for was to force him to sit down with detectives to make a recorded statement about what had happened nearly 5 years earlier on the night of the Boston shootings. The prosecution was obligated to turn over the transcripts of this interview, and did so one day after court. Initially, I didn't think much of it. I just put the papers in my briefcase and headed back to the defense team apartments on Devonshire Place, where we always had our meetings to review what went on that day in court and prepare for the next day's events. After our meeting, I sat down to review the transcripts and could not believe my eyes. The interview was conducted by the co-lead detectives on the case, Detectives Paul McIsaac and Detective Joshua Cummings, another officer assigned to the case. McMaster began telling them the story of how he drove through the crime scene and saw a woman with her head sticking out of the sunroof of the SUV, holding a cell phone. "Oh my God," I blurted out. "He was the first to come up on the scene and actually saw the immediate aftermath." It's no wonder all the officers testifying about the crime scene did not see the street sweeper. He drove by before the police arrived. McMaster was now the third independent witness who would describe someone that looked like a female in the passenger seat of the SUV where the prosecution was saying Aaron sat. I don't care how you slice it or how bad your eyesight is. There is no way you could mistake Aaron for a female or a guy with shoulder-length cornrows. We also had the three witnesses, the fan Junior Salvador, and the two bouncers from Club Cure saying he was over by the W at the time of the murder. What McMaster saw was not the only bombshell he had to offer. When Detective McIsaac asked him why he didn't say anything about a woman hanging out of the sunroof of the SUV on the night of the shootings, McMaster responded,
"I'm 100% positive of this. I stated that there was a girl. Honestly, Boston PD was kind of treating me kind of like dreadful. They said, 'Keep your mouth shut or you're going to get arrested.'"
McIsaac then asked during the interview, "Who said that to you?"
"An officer said that. 'Shut your fucking mouth. This is a homicide investigation. You'll be under arrest, blah, blah, blah.' Honestly, at the time, I was, like, kind of frozen."
The detectives then inquired whether he had given a uniformed officer this information or a plainclothes detective. McMaster said he told them both. Detective McIsaac immediately went into self-preservation mode by informing McMaster he was, in fact, one of the officers he spoke with that night, and McMaster never told him anything of the kind. The problem with Detective McIsaac was that he now had a conflict of interest, as it was turning into what looked like a serious case of obstruction of justice or destruction of evidence issue. Detective Cummings should have excused Detective McIsaac and continued the interview on his own. Instead, Cummings allowed McIsaac to continue questioning and arguably coaching a primary witness in a murder investigation. McIsaac continued with leading questions.
"Question. All right. Do you remember it being me? Or do you remember speaking to a detective? Answer. Yes. Question. All right. 'Cause that night you didn't mention anything about this SUV and the girl hanging out.' Answer. I'm pretty 100% sure I stated that there was—" He's interrupted with another question. Notice McIsaac is now telling him what happened, not asking him. This flies in the face of what a proper interview should be. It is to get information, not to give it. McIsaac continues relentlessly. Question. Yeah, but you never mentioned anything about a woman hanging out of an SUV. Answer. I'm pretty 100% positive of this. I stated that there was a girl. Honestly, the Boston PD was kind of treating me kind like dreadful. They told me not to say none of this to no one. They said, 'Keep your mouth shut or you're going to be arrested.' Question.
Is that why you didn't tell me anything? McIsaac leads him to get himself off the hook.
Answer. Yeah, and I just kept my mouth shut.
Question. So you weren't treated properly, you thought?
Answer. No, no.
Question. And then when you spoke to me, you just didn't tell me?
Answer. I just didn't say anything.
McIsaac, a seasoned detective questioning this kid, knew exactly how to lead him down the right path. I say this confidently because throughout the interview, the street sweeper made it clear he did not recognize McIsaac or recall speaking to him that evening. McMaster followed up these questions.
Answer. I might not have told you, but I know I told other officers there.
Detective McIsaac continued to lead him and tell the street sweeper facts in an intimidating fashion. They were outright statements, not questions. Judge for yourself.
Question. What I'm saying, you and I had the conversation. You told me that you were coming off. You were on the far side, you went by, you saw the BMW, and you kept going on your route until you were called back. I mean, you never told me anything about this white BMW or anything like that. White SUV.
Answer. Honestly, I couldn't remember anyone because it was dark, too, and, like, there was a lot of people down at the time, and there were lights, a lot of situations going on, and, like, I really, honestly, I can't remember talking to you, honestly.
Question. Well, no, I mean, I'm the one that actually spoke to you that night.
My blood was boiling as I read this. Here they were in a recorded interview trying to get a witness to back off a statement he made and telling him what he did and did not say that evening. One key fact you should note is that Detective McIsaac filled out many reports in this case and noted every interview he did in the entire 3-year investigation. He even had to turn over a notepad in which he jotted down things he did in the investigation. There is not one single mention anywhere on any document in the 34,000 pages of this case that Detective Paul McIsaac ever spoke with the street sweeper on the evening of the shootings. How can they do this, you might ask?
Because they can.
The very next day, we filed a motion to dismiss, and 4 days later, we stopped the trial and had a full-blown hearing in front of Judge Locke without the jury present. I got my first look at Warren McMaster out in the hallway before he entered, while I was speaking to Prosecutor Mark Lee. The animosity between them was quickly apparent. I wasn't sure if McMaster's animosity was against Lee or all of us, so I thought I really needed to take a soft approach with McMaster. As he took the stand, McMaster's frustration was apparent. You could see him rolling his eyes, fidgeting in his seat, and answering all of Lee's questions with an attitude. I wasn't sure what Lee was attempting to accomplish with his direct examination other than to get a brief overview of the events and what McMaster told law enforcement on that evening and during his interview with McIsaac and Cummings. Lee's questioning wasn't clear, but one thing was certain, and that was that McMaster wasn't happy with how police treated him the night of the shooting. "The police were being rowdy to me," he declared with a thick Boston accent.
"And how were they being rowdy to you?" asked Lee.
"By telling me to shut the fuck up, sit the fuck down, tie 4 fucking shoes," Lee pressed on. "But what exactly did they say to you?" "It was fuck this, fuck that, fuck, 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 fuck."
An undiscouraged Lee continued as if it was going to help his cause. "So you said hi and they said fuck?"
"Pretty much, they said hi back and then it was fuck, 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 fuck. They kept getting in my face, violating my rights, telling me if I told anybody anything, they were going to have me arrested," said McMaster, who wasn't backing down. As I rose, I knew I was not going to make the same mistake, so I let McMaster take me where he wanted to take me.
After making it clear that he in fact did tell multiple police officers on the night of the shootings that there was a white or light-colored SUV on the scene, and what could have been a woman outside the sunroof with a phone or recording device, we moved over to the interview with the detectives at the courthouse.
Lee had tried unsuccessfully to get McMaster to admit he remembered speaking to McIsaac the night of the shootings. So I began there.
"Did you feel that they were trying to get you to say what they wanted you to say?" I asked.
"Yeah, this one guy kept trying to get me to say that I remembered him from that night, but I honestly don't remember speaking to him at all," McMaster responded calmly.
"And did he try to tell you that multiple times?" I asked, already knowing the answer.
"Yes," he answered unequivocally.
Then I got a piece of information we didn't have.
Warren mentioned that the prosecution and cops spoke with him the previous day to try and coach him some more.
"What was the purpose of this meeting?" I asked.
"They were trying to prep me, you know, prep me towards their side of the case," McMaster said, in what could have been the best James Cagney impersonation I had ever heard.
"And what were they doing in this meeting?" I continued.
They started getting rowdy to me, and I kind of got rowdy back because I wasn't going to say things the way they wanted, McMaster said of his meeting with prosecutors a day earlier.
Did they record this meeting? I asked.
No, they talk to you different when they're recording you, he responded, offering another gem.
How are they different? I asked.
They're much nicer when they record you, McMaster mumbled quietly.
I then asked a question I didn't know the answer to.
Were any prosecutors there?
I don't know what prosecutors may have been there, he answered unclearly, so I pressed. Were any of the three prosecutors sitting here in this courtroom there yesterday?
McMaster took a second, leaned back, twitched his mouth to the side, and nodded his head with a grin.
Yeah, Mr. Wang or Mr. Chang over there, he said, pointing at Mark Lee. It was at this moment I had to remind myself I was a grown-up and wasn't allowed to laugh. But that didn't stop the entire courtroom, including the press corps, from laughing.
And he was getting rowdy with you, too? I couldn't help but ask.
Yeah, and he kept talking down to me like I was stupid or something, he concluded.
Warren McMaster, in all of his colorfulness, could not have been a more important witness for the defense. He was a living and breathing representation of the culture of police work shaping this investigation. I specifically limit my comments to this case because I have not worked on enough cases in Boston to say this is an agency-wide problem. But clearly, in this case, we were in the Wild West. McMaster's statements thus far had come during his interviews with police, prosecutors, and the hearing with the judge. While it would be difficult, I knew we were going to have to get McMaster in front of the jury, but it would be a gamble. The jury could be turned off by his colorfulness and just think this was a rowdy kid with a beef with the police, and discount the important information he had to give. So rather than have him blow up on me in front of the jury, I entrusted him to Michelle Medina, my right-hand and trusted associate. Do not coach him, but get him to calm down and be more presentable, I told her. She did just that. After taking the stand with the jury present, the street sweeper was the talk of the town and on the internet. People thought he was the funniest thing since Eddie Murphy, but they also accused him of being on drugs. He didn't like it. He was, by all accounts we could find, a very street-smart young man, a good kid who had the same job for several years and always helped provide for his extended family. McMaster repeatedly said he felt pressured and disrespected by the police. So Michelle explained to him that when we called him, it would be his opportunity to make it right and come across like a sincere and honest young man. However, I felt we needed more than Warren McMaster. I felt we needed some type of corroboration of his testimony. I gave our interns an assignment to track down the police officer who actually saw the street sweeper. In a stroke of luck, we found him. Officer O'Donnell, the only officer to mention the street sweeper in his report from the night of the shootings. When we called him to the stand during the trial, Officer O'Donnell told the jury that upon his arrival near the scene, he saw the street sweeper pass the BMW and turn onto Harold Street. Officer O'Donnell was a straight-up, by-the-book veteran of the Boston Police Department. Bald-headed, portly, with silver-rimmed glasses and all business. He said that once Sergeant Clifton McHale arrived and took charge of the crime scene, O'Donnell told him about seeing a street sweeper drive past the BMW. That led to McMaster's supervisor calling and telling him to get back to the scene. In my closing arguments, you can be sure that I pointed out what I knew the jury was thinking. Why did the prosecutors call approximately 15 police officers to the stand? Some testifying to very little other than they were there that night. But they didn't call the guy who saw the street sweeper. They called the first officer, the fourth officer, the tenth officer, and so on, but never considered calling Officer O'Donnell, who arrived second and immediately following the incident. The inescapable fact is they knew the street sweeper was going to hurt them, and they were going to try and keep him as far away from the jury as they could. After Officer O'Donnell stepped down from the stand, we called the street sweeper. Warren McMaster took the stand in front of the jury. He was nicely dressed, clean-shaven, and as clear and concise as could be. He told the jury what he saw and what he told the police and what they told him. He did slip at one point and refer to Mark Lee as Mr. Wang again, but it was under his breath, and I'm not sure anyone even heard it. The following day, during a courtroom break, I joked with Mark Lee about it, and he rolled his eyes. Always good-humored, he said, "You know, I can't fucking shake that nickname. My own wife is now calling me Mr. Wang." Chapter 19. Marinating the Jury. Technically, the prosecution doesn't have to prove motive, but I believe they were extremely concerned about the weakness of their argument from the start.
Patrick Hagen made a point of telling the jury during his opening statements that none of this would make sense. This was his way of saying he really had no motive. The reason Aaron committed murder is not going to make sense to you, but you should believe that he did it anyway. Meanwhile, I was trying to keep the jury focused on these questions. Why are we all here? Why are we spending weeks of our time trying to connect Aaron Hernandez to a crime he had no reason to commit? Why are we trying to invent a motive? I was pounding the weakness of the prosecution's case. A high-profile trial is a big deal. I knew it would be hard for jurors, who make great sacrifices and endure tremendous inconveniences to perform their duty, to believe they were there over a spilled drink. Proof that a drink was spilled on Aaron, and that it made him angry, was critical to the prosecution's argument. One thing that never became public, and we kept pretty close to the vest throughout, was that before the trial began, a gentleman serving in the army in Kuwait had emailed our office and told us of an encounter he had with Aaron in the summer of 2012, around the same time as the Cure incident. He told us he was home in Boston on leave and was in a club. He believed it was Rumor or Cure, and a hot girl walked by with a really nice ass. He said both he and Aaron were so distracted that he accidentally spilled his drink on Aaron. Rather than blow up, Aaron laughed it off and told the guy, who was apologizing profusely, not to worry about it. Aaron even went so far as to buy the guy a drink to replace the one spilled on him. The Army combat veteran seemed more than willing to testify, but at some point got cold feet. He started to avoid us, and we went to great lengths to try and get him served with a subpoena in Kuwait. But after contacting the State Department and calling in favors from some very influential people, he was successful in hiding on his base in Kuwait and never getting served. His commanding officer did not want to accept service for him, so we were ultimately unsuccessful in calling him. My theory is this guy really wanted to help Aaron out during his trial, but his superior officers wanted no part of it and pressured him to stay away. Having served in the military, I know there is nothing more persuasive than a commanding officer putting pressure on an enlisted man, especially while serving abroad. Based on the timing and the descriptions given by this witness, I believe this incident was actually the inspiration for Bradley's spilled drink story. I believe it really happened, and that Bradley was with him when it did. Many lies start out as truths, and grow from there. When I questioned Aaron about the encounter, he remembered the guy, but never put two and two together that this is where Bradley might have gotten the story. We also planned on calling Patriots coach Bill Belichick to talk about the request to be traded that Aaron made during their meeting in Indianapolis. When we finally served him, he was in Miami attending a pro day at the University of Miami, preparing for the NFL draft. Lots of things happened behind the scenes of high-profile trials that would make headlines across the country if the public knew about them. In my opinion, prosecution's late-game decision to throw a Hail Mary pass to establish motive was one of the most explosive. Just before the trial started, we got some police reports indicating that Boston PD flew to Arizona to interview a woman who had created a pen pal relationship with Aaron. This woman was in her 40s, and I believe even married, but she was completely infatuated with Aaron. She would deposit money in Aaron's commissary account. They exchanged letters often, and the relationship got a little deeper than they expected. But it was still just a correspondence. I really don't believe Aaron had any genuine feelings for her, but clearly it felt good to be cared about, and this woman expressed her love for him in many ways. Maybe she was fulfilling some kind of fantasy for him as well. Police went to pay her a visit. For what purpose, I still don't know, other than to try to find as much dirt as possible on Aaron, or at the very least get another little trip on the taxpayer's dollar. The woman told them Aaron had ended their relationship. Aaron told me as well that he had ended it because he knew the trial was coming up, and if the media went snooping into his phone calls or correspondence, news of the relationship would hurt Shayana. Shayana may have been a bit more forgiving while Aaron was free, but their relationship was strained by his incarceration, and Aaron was afraid he would lose her once and for all. So he sent this woman, who I won't identify, a Dear Jane letter that she claimed to no longer have in her possession. Why wouldn't she have kept the letter, I wondered. Anyway, the woman told police that in the letter, Aaron told her he could no longer be with her because he was having feelings for men, and that it would not be fair to her to continue a relationship or love affair because he did not look at women in that way. He also supposedly told her he was angry because of this built-up frustration and inability to be who he really was. He, according to her, was angry all the time, but did not know why. At some point in the trial, Pat Hagen approached me and told me the Commonwealth was considering calling this woman to the stand to tell her story, thus creating a motive for the shootings. Hagen told us she would testify that Aaron was a closeted homosexual. The frustration and anger of being a closeted homosexual made him overcompensate as a man. So whenever anyone challenged his manhood, like Daniel De Abreu supposedly did when he spilled his drink on Aaron, he would overreact and get angry enough to kill. In essence, being a closeted homosexual made Aaron a killer. This was by far the biggest reach I had ever seen a prosecutor make in an effort to establish motive, which the judge instructs the jury the prosecution does not have to prove. Usually, salacious details about someone's sexual preferences or relationships are kept out of a court of law, because they can be more prejudicial against the accused than probative.
But Hagen and company did not care.
They were all in, and with things turning out the way they were, the prosecution was flat-out desperate. When we went into chambers, Judge Locke agreed to discuss this off the record. Hagen laid out his theory, and I watched the look on Locke's face, one of growing confusion. So what you're saying is that men who are in the closet are more prone to kill than men who are openly gay or straight men? Asked Locke. That's exactly what he's saying, Judge, I chimed in, even though I was not invited to do so. No, Hagen said. What we are saying is that Aaron Hernandez was angry all of the time. He didn't even enjoy playing football anymore either. Now, I knew this was bullshit. Aaron and I would talk for hours about football, and he talked about it like a kid getting ready to go to the park to play. Where was Hagen coming from? Apparently, the police had gotten that from Bradley, and this woman had confirmed it. I could see Coach McIsaac was at it again. And how do you plan on proving this? Are you thinking of calling some kind of expert to talk about this? Locke asked. The judge was trying his best to be noncommittal, but his questions were clear. He wasn't buying it, and Hagen's new motive was falling by the wayside just as fast as the first one. At the end of the meeting, Hagen said he was going to discuss it with his team, and we all realized we would have to have a gay hearing on this issue, so both sides should be prepared to argue their points with supporting case law. George Leontire, or Mr. Devonshire as I like to call him, based on the way he pronounced the name of the building we were staying in with his thick Boston accent, was openly gay. He was the most aggressive and non-effeminate member of the team. He was livid. I'm not sure if Hagen and company knew George was gay. I don't really think anyone knew. I have never paid attention to these sorts of things, nor have I ever had to deal with such nonsense from the prosecution in a court of law. When my team met on this issue, George was ready to storm the prosecutor's office and show them that a guy out of the closet could kill just as easily as one in the closet. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and I told George, "Let's not kill anybody just yet." Instead, George began making a list of every significant member of the LGBT community he was going to start making calls to. The next day, when we went sidebar to discuss the matter briefly, I was about to make a point when George, always at every sidebar but off to the side, decided this was the time to literally bump lead counsel out of the way and put his two cents in. When I tell you he bumped me out of the way, I mean it. George outweighs me by about 75 pounds. He literally got in Hagen's face and said, "If you guys even think about pulling a stunt like this, I promise you that I will have every single member of the LGBT community ready to protest outside and in this courtroom. You will start a firestorm that you, sir, would not be able to contain." While I remember these words as if they were spoken yesterday, I still don't think I'm doing the incident justice. This was literally the last we heard of the prosecution's gay motive. The trial continued, and so did the shenanigans. Aaron had tattoos all over his body. Some were interesting motivational quotes, some were football-related, but most were religious in nature. But 8 months after the Boston shootings and a couple months after the West Palm Beach incident, Aaron got several tattoos, two of which were of guns. One was a cylinder of a revolver with 5 bullets in it. One hole was left empty. The other one was a muzzle of what appeared to be a semi-automatic weapon. A bullet was out of it, and smoke was coming from the muzzle. Prosecutors would argue that these two tattoos were confessions written on Aaron's body. I believe cops were tipped off about these tattoos because Aaron had received some text messages from the tattoo artist asking when he was going to come in for more tattoos. Three detectives then flew across the country to speak with the tattoo artist and all his colleagues, hoping Aaron said or did something that amounted to a confession. This was amazing dedication on law enforcement's part. You have to wonder, would they have gone through this much trouble and expense to track these leads down to find the killer of Daniel De Abreu and Saphiro Furtado had Aaron Hernandez not been the suspect? That's the thing about high-profile cases. Cops will spare no expense and stop at nothing to get you. The prosecution's theory was that they recovered 5 bullets from the crime scene, and the gun used was the antique six-shooter. Only the killer would know there were 5 bullets in the gun. Their theory was that the tattoo depicted the gun used to shoot Bradley. The tattoo was literally their smoking gun. I have to admit that as crazy as their idea sounded,
I thought a jury just might buy it.
After all, everyone has heard of gangsters who get tattoos of teardrops to signify how many people they have killed. In fact, I tried a case just like that several years ago in Miami, in which my client was an accused gangbanger called YLO Negro. The YLO stood for Young Latin Organization, a local gang in a neighborhood just outside of Miami's Little Havana. YLO was accused of first-degree murder. He had these stupid teardrops tattooed below his eye, meant to signify the tears of his victims. We could not put him in front of the jury with those tattoos, so we came up with the clever idea of using makeup to cover them up. YLO was only 22, but he, like Bradley, had 9 lives. He had been shot twice, stabbed multiple times, run over and left for dead on the side of the road. He managed to survive, but was permanently disabled, and walked with a severe limp similar to that of Kevin Spacey's character Verbal in The Usual Suspects. Apparently, the Young Latin Organization does not discriminate against the handicapped. In walks the jury, and the prosecutor begins her questioning of the jury. Everything is going fine until the prosecutor starts to question the jury about the potential of feeling sorry for the defendant for being handicapped. She then goes into this long story about how he was stabbed multiple times and left for dead in a fight. It was a very sad story. I began to think this might actually help us make YLO a little more sympathetic to the jury. Unfortunately, it made him look so sympathetic that several people began to tear up a bit, including YLO himself. As I turned to tell him to stop crying, he wiped one of his tears, removing the makeup and exposing the tattoos. While he wasn't convicted of murder, the jury was not about to let that guy back on the streets. They convicted him of a lesser charge. I learned a lesson the hard way. Jurors pay close attention to tattoos. And while some people get tattoos that actually mean something, many people get them just because they think they look good. I think Aaron did a combination of both. Aaron said he got the gun tattoos because he liked guns. That was that. Trust me, Jose. I know you think I'm stupid, but damn, I wouldn't be stupid enough to tattoo a confession on me and then go show it to millions of people every Sunday, Aaron quipped. When I first learned the prosecution was going to pursue this angle, I knew we were going to fight its admissibility.
Because nowhere, in any case across the country, has tattoo evidence ever been admitted for the purpose of a confession or substantive evidence.
Tattoos are commonly used to identify somebody, but no one has successfully proven the meaning of a tattoo. It's too subjective. We filed multiple motions and Judge Locke went back and forth trying to decide if he would admit the tattoos as evidence. In the end, he admitted them, and the fight was on to try and discredit the tattooed confession. The prosecution called the tattoo artist to the stand to testify about the tattoos and admitted photographs of them. Then they did something really clever. They took a picture of the gun with the cylinder open, put 5 bullets in it, leaving one chamber empty, and put it side by side with the picture of the tattoo. The similarity was eerie and did not bode well for the defense. But still something was off. I just couldn't place it. I held a little contest among our interns and promised I would buy dinner for the one who could go online and find a tattoo exactly the same, but nobody could find one. So the night before I was to cross-examine the tattoo artist, I went online myself, and as I was Googling images, I realized what was off about the tattoo. The artist had drawn the cylinder backward. The tattoo was just a picture of the cylinder, no gun, so I kept arguing that distinction. I wanted to downplay the significance of the tattoo in front of the jury. I didn't want them to think we were afraid of it. I rose to cross-examine the tattoo artist. "Sir, did they really fly you out here to talk about tattoos?" I asked derisively.
I guess so," he answered.
My point was made. Then I pointed out how the cylinder was drawn backward, and the bullets couldn't be loaded from the angle shown. They'd have to go in through the other side. "What does this mean to someone?" I asked the tattoo artist.
"I have no idea," he said. "Does it mean something has backfired in his life?" I pressed.
"I have no idea," he repeated. The next point we made, I can't take credit for. It was all Aaron. When Aaron saw me struggling over the pictures of the tattoos, he said, "Jose, you should point out the gun used to shoot Bradley was a .40 caliber. The muzzle of that tattoo is the muzzle of a Colt .45.
"What?" I asked.
"Yeah, look at it and you can tell. The muzzle of a Colt .45 is very distinctive.
He said this word for word, and for a moment I thought to myself, damn, this kid could have been anything he wanted to be in this world, and look at him now. How the hell do you know that? I asked.
Duh, I'm the one who picked it out, he responded with a smile.